with radio for the musically impaired.
But I couldn't survive without a radio.
Well, that's it for me, my little angels. I will see you next time.
The Beatle Paul may be dead.
This is Tom Donahue, and that's all for tonight.
My next stop is Vietnam.
I'm Allison Steele, the Nightbird.
I'm the Wolfman.
Murray the K, Sapping the T, and as the fifth Beatle.
Hey, King Wasabi.
This is Arnie, woo-woo, Ginsburg.
And this is Dick Beyond the
E, Kittle Yacht.
Ho, this is Jack.
Loosest new song.
What's all right?
I'm free here. The station is WINS. The beat, the big beat, the biggest of them all. Rock and roll.
And here we go to rockin'. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, the subject of this show is a new documentary called Airplay, The Rise and Fall of Rock Radio. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you the lady who is, along with her husband, responsible for that documentary. Her documentaries have won critical acclaim from the New York Times and also many industry awards. And her recent documentary, Wildwood Days, about the summer resort that gave birth to rock and roll, was featured at 8 different film festivals. It's my pleasure to introduce this lady who says, "You can judge a society by how it treats its animals and its documentary producers." Ladies and gentlemen, here is Carolyn Travis. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
And I love a man that reads my website. I'm very honored. I've listened to some of your interviews, and I'm in extremely good company.
Well, thank you very much. And you interviewed so many people in this particular film.
It was wonderful. I got to be, 10 years old with a transistor under my pillow again.
The people in this film that are featured are like a who's who of the broadcasting industry of the past 50 years, specifically relating to rock and roll. In the glory days of radio, there were personalities like, and I guess the first one that comes to my mind is Alan Freed, of course, because Alan Freed actually came along before it was called rock and roll. He was playing these rhythm and blues records, and they're referred to in the film as the devil's music, initially. After Alan Freed, there were DJs like Cousin Brucey, Murray the K, Dan Ingram, Jerry Blabbitt, Casey Kasem, who I have a very close connection with, incidentally, Dick Biondi, Wolfman Jack, among others. And all of these people are featured in this film.
Now I'm impressed. And, for everyone I got, there were one or two that we unfortunately didn't get while they were still with us, and I wish I'd gotten, but I'm glad I got the ones I did.
Certainly in the context of the music that he was playing, Alan Freed coined the term rock and roll, even though the term was actually used on an old Boswell Sisters record, I think in the 30s, but it was a different context.
It was used a lot before that, too. There were a lot of R&B records that, like Dan Ingram says in the show, that were euphemisms for sex Roll With Me, Henry. But Alan Freed was the first person that actually called it rock and roll in relation to the music itself.
Alan Freed became the number one DJ in the country.
Oh, yeah.
And he did something that was pretty different. Now, he took music that was produced primarily by black recording artists.
Mm-hmm.
The music that he was playing was very much a contrast from the music that the adults liked. And as a perfect example, during the film, you play a little bit of the Perry Como record, Papa Loves Mambo. Nice little song, but it wasn't something that the kids were really into.
No. And this was really, post-war America. They call it the first generation of teenagers. Of course, people had been, teenage before. But it was the first generation that really had disposable income and freedom. And, more of them were actually staying in school and being kids longer. So it was the first time that there was actually a market for music and television and people to sell to. That kind of helped sell the music, too. Now, Alan wasn't the first one to play the R&B. There were people around the country that were doing it, but Alan was the first one that really became famous. I think because he was in New York and in Cleveland, he was in major markets. But it had been done. There were people all around the country. I think Hunter Hancock in L.A., and there were guys in Nashville, John Orr, Rich Berg, and Huss Allen, and Gene Nobles, who were playing it out of a station called WLAC in Nashville. It was a very powerful station that was heard over a lot of the country. But most of those were like late night or overnight shows, and they didn't have the popularity that Alan Freed got. Alan Freed really brought the music into the mainstream.
This is not something that you put together quickly by any means. In fact, I understand that this film took you approximately 10 years to produce. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it started out as Golden Age of AM. I really wanted to do a show on AM, and then I did that. And then I said, you know, FM has a lot of interesting things, too. So I extended it. And then as I was doing that, satellite came into its own. And we said, well, let's just do the whole thing. So, we just kept expanding the show as we went along. So, yes, it was a whole 10-year project in the end.
I understand that part of your inspiration for doing this documentary had to do with a disc jockey and an animal.
Yes, I used to listen to Jerry Blavitt and the guys on Wivage when I used to spend summers in Wildwood, but I would get Cousin Brucey on WABC at night. Even though I grew up in Maryland, we could get WABC, and he was the DJ I remembered best, and I said, if I can get him to do this, then I'm going to do it, because without him, it's just not going to work. And he used to do shows at Palisades Park, and he had a little poodle that he would dress in matching outfits, and they all both had leopard jackets, and it was part of his shtick. And I wrote, and I said, I wasn't lucky enough to grow up in New York or go to Palisades Park and see your shows, but my dog and I have matching sweaters. Will you do this? And he called me, and he said, it's Cousin Brucey, and yes, I will. And I went, that's it. It's a sign.
Ah! I think the dog's name was Muffin, right?
Yes, Muffin.
Before I go any further, I would like to mention that you did this project with your husband.
Yeah, my husband, Chris Gilson. His background was actually advertising and commercial production. And when I was working on this, I would always come in and say, what do you think of this and what do you think of that? And he says, well, I have some thoughts. Why don't we just do this together? So, you know, we did collaborate. A lot of the editing, I always say he's the magic and I'm the heart, because I'm the one that loves DJs. I'm the one that could probably name every DJ in every market that I ever heard of. And he's the magic. He does all the cool special effects and the editing. And between the two of us, we came up with something we both love and stayed married through the whole project.
I cannot imagine any more comprehensive job that you could have done. I mean, it runs a little over 90 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
95.
I just can't see how you could have done it better. You got to just about everybody that was relevant to tell the story of how initially it was AM radio that emerged, because the AM came before the FM. Well, the FM was out there, but what was FM playing? Mostly classical
FM was
music.
Playing mostly classical or foreign language or simulcast.
See, or simulcasting the AM.
Most cars didn't have FM radios. I don't think any of them did
right.
In the 50s. So the advertisers weren't interested in them at all.
It's kind of, to make an analogy, these days not everybody has satellite radio.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, not everybody had FM radio.
Exactly.
Well, you tell the story. We're going to go back to Alan Freed now. And one of the highlights of the film is that you have an extended interview with Alan Freed's son, Lance Freed. Tell us a little bit about Lance.
He's actually in the music business himself. He has a company called Rondor Music. And he was just a kid when all this happened. He was like 12 years old.
Want to point out, yes, of course, you're going to see interviews with the DJs, but more than that, when you watch this film, you also see them in action doing actual radio shows. You see performance clips of people like Little Richard, Fats Domino, Frankie Lyman, and the Teenagers.
The Moon Glows a little bit.
Yeah, the Moon Glows. It's not just like you're reading about something or seeing still pictures. You're seeing action pictures. You actually feel that you're living this over. Those who remember it are reliving it, and those who don't remember it, did not live during that period of time, will be able to experience it for the first time.
And what I found interesting is, you know, these people were really big celebrities in their day. Nobody filmed themselves. I couldn't believe it when we went to look for footage. I mean, you know, we interviewed the people ourselves, like Dick Biondi, and he didn't have one strip of film of themselves in a studio. Even Rachel Donahue, Tom Donahue's widow, Rachel, is in the show. I mean, Tom started FM Underground Radio, and before that he was actually a Philadelphia AM radio personality. And the only footage we had of him was from a movie they did. These people, I mean, anyone that's in radio now that's listening, please take a camera and film yourself in a studio, because someday some documentary producer will thank you for that.
Yeah. We talk about Alan Freed, of course. He started out, he was doing the Moondog Show.
Mm-hmm.
Was that originally in Cleveland?
Yes.
Unfortunately, you know, when you become the number one DJ in the country, you're going to make a lot of friends, but there's also going to be people that are your enemies. Mm-hmm. And Alan Freed had his enemies, unfortunately.
Yes, he did. Well, I don't think Moondog, the real Moondog, was so much an enemy as somebody who just... He was a... You know, it's funny because I remember seeing the other Moondog.
We should say who the other Moondog is.
He was a jazz musician who used to perform in a Viking helmet on the corner of 6th Avenue and I believe it's 54th, right across from the New York Hilton.
Really?
And I remember I would go to New York and shop with my mom and we'd see him on the corner. I thought he was just some street guy. I didn't know who he was. But when Alan came to New York and started using the name Moondog, Moondog the musician sued him and won.
But all it really meant is he couldn't use the Moondog name anymore.
He was always used the name Alan Freed. Moondog was just another part of the show. But, oh yeah, Alan Freed always used his own name. But yeah, he wasn't allowed to use the name Moondog as part of his show, and that's when he came up with using rock and roll.
What Alan Freed did was he would play the original versions of the songs.
Yes, he would.
And that was something that kind of made him different from other DJs who would play for the adults. And he built up a name, coined the term rock and roll. Unfortunately, during his career, as much as he tried to promote rock and roll, well, that turned out to be kind of his undoing. There were two separate riots. I think it was two separate incidents.
He did something called the Moondog Coronation Ball in Cleveland, where they had oversold tickets, and it started a riot. And, of course, at that time period in the 50s, the authorities were looking for anything to make rock and roll look bad. And I'm sure it happened other places in other venues, but they made an example out of Alan Freed.
That was not actually what did him in.
The second riot was in Boston, which was a notoriously conservative city.
Before he did the show, I think he was warned, you better not do a show here.
Yeah.
It was certainly a difficult time, and it certainly received a lot of headlines, but not the type that he wanted to receive. Unfortunately, he was perceived by many as a bad guy, because he was bringing what's referred to here as the devil's music, and it was just an unfortunate turn of events. Actually, there's a film, which I assume that you probably have seen, called American Hot Wax.
Oh, of course.
Tim McIntyre played the role of Alan Freed. It was a kind of an interesting film. It had some historical inaccuracies, but still it gave people an idea of what went on.
Yes.
Of course, in this film, Airplay, you're actually seeing footage of what went on. And there's several action shots of Alan Freed, by the way.
Well, Alan, luckily for us, did movies.
Oh, yeah.
And as Lance said, the worst acting he's ever seen in his life. So he was one of the ones that we were lucky enough to find a lot of footage. We did have a tiny, tiny little clip from American Hot Wax in there, too. So if somebody is listening to this and they go, she's lying, there was American Hot Wax in there. There is a little clip, so I think it's a crowd shot. Can't lie. Can't lie to your audience.
Okay.
Yes, there is a lot. In fact, Alan's daughter-in-law, Lance's ex-wife Judy Freed, has an amazing website called alanfreed.com. where she has spent years gathering pictures and documents from the Paola trial and just amazing amount of information.
Right.
And it's a really fun site.
In its glory days, we had Alan Freed, and Alan Freed was very powerful, and he was very popular.
He was the number one disc jockey in the country.
The kids loved him. Unfortunately, power brings a lot of jealousy and other emotions. Rock and roll radio had powerful enemies that were bent on destroying it. I have a question now about the Paola hearings that took place. Why did Congress decide to do these hearings? What was the purpose?
Well, there are a lot of different theories on that. One was it was an election year, and they were looking for an issue. They had pretty much fallen flat with the quiz show scandals because nothing really happened. But I'm sure there were a lot of conservatives out there who had kids that blasted rock and roll in the bedroom, and they were trying to find a way to get rid of it. And also, it was an election issue. You know, this music that's corrupting our youth, and we didn't get to put everything in, but we are doing a website, and there were clips of a preacher named Reverend Jimmy Snow who would do this sermon. He says, "What is it about rock and roll? It's the beat, the beat, the beat." You know, like, come on, what do you think it was? And there were people that really were out to get it. You know, when they found out that these disc jockeys were taking money, Paola wasn't illegal then. See, that's what a lot of people don't get. The mistake they made is they never declared the money on their income tax. So that was the little chink in the armor that they used to get to these guys.
Did Alan Freed testify at those hearings?
Yes. And Dick Clark, and there's another guy on our show, Joe Finan from Cleveland, who was the first disc jockey to testify at those hearings. And there's actually footage of him coming out, and he said to us, he went in there not knowing what was going to happen. And he thought that they had found out that there was this impropriety and they were going to come up with new legislation to control it. And then he went in there, and they just threw the book at him.
Representative Harris, by the time he was finished, I thought, I must be public enemy number one. And my wife tears streaming down her face. And I said, oh my God, it was the worst time in my life. I wasn't angry till I got outside.
I came down here with the full intention of freely cooperating and helping this committee in what I thought their work was, that to establish points of departure for new legislation. After cooperating freely before the same committee, I was pilloried, termed pathetic by Chairman Orrin Harris.
And a friend of mine who's black said later, man, they've been doing that to us for a long time. Just bend over, Charlie.
He lost his job. I mean, he had a career after that, but he did lose that job over the bail hearing. A lot of disc jockeys did.
Including Alan Freed, and here's what his son Lance had to say about that.
They came to him and said, sign this affidavit that says you've never, ever accepted a gift of any kind at any time to play records, that you don't have any publishing interests, you never got any benefit from the records you play. And he said, well, I can't sign this. And they said, well, then you're fired.
To our wonderful friends here and all of you out there for your great loyalty, this is not goodbye, it's just good night, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.
There were kids all around him, I remember, in tears, saying, we love you, Alan, we love you, what are we going to do without you? And he said, you guys made this music, this is yours, it's up to you to keep it going.
If I'm guilty of anything, I'm guilty of being present at the birth of rock and roll.
And within 2 weeks, our house was seized in Connecticut by the Internal Revenue Service. We weren't even allowed to go in and get our clothes.
Now, of course, Dick Clark and American Bandstand were becoming very, very popular, and somehow Dick Clark emerged relatively unscathed from these hearings.
Yes.
One of the people interviewed in your film said that it was almost like the congressmen were treating him as like he deserved the Medal of Honor.
Yeah, that was Joe Finan, who lost his job, and Dick walked away and he went back to his extremely successful TV show. Well, you know, I think ABC had a lot of interest in protecting Dick Clark. You know, the thing was, none of them were doing anything that terrible. And Dick Clark did lose a lot of money. He had a lot of interest in publishing companies and record labels, and they said, look, you have a choice, either give up the show or give up your outside interests.
Right.
But yeah, he did get off rather easy, because it would have been a big blow to ABC to lose American Bandstand.
I'm Ronnie Allen, and it is my pleasure to be talking with Carolyn Travis, and you are both the producer and the director. I'm almost afraid to ask what the difference is, because it might take a half an hour to explain it.
No, I code everything with my husband. We co-produce, co-wrote, co-directed. Director is the creative part of it. The producer makes it happen.
Okay.
And we try to do a little of both, because we both had visions. Not always the same vision, but visions.
Well, we're still together.
Yes, we are.
as being a producer, that includes getting the licensing rights to all the songs and the clips and stuff?
Well, or being smart enough to delegate to researchers.
Oh, or delegate.
But it's really just putting the whole thing together and finding the right people to do the right things.
Well, we're going to move on right now, and sadly, Alan Freed died at the age of 44. Mm-hmm. He was a broken man. It was very, very sad.
It was, because it was unnecessary. You ask any disc jockey that was around, and they all said the same thing when we talked to them. He just was not treated fairly. They needed a scapegoat, and they found one.
I like him to be remembered, if not for the controversy, but just as a good man who really had good instincts and who loved what he did, and it happened to affect a lot of people in a really positive way.
Alan Freed was the best-known person to lose his job, but several DJs throughout the country lost their job. We're going to move on now to the glory days of radio. We're going to mention some other personalities. Cousin Brucey started out on Wins. Actually, started out on a station before Wins, but became really a big name on radio station WINS 1010 Wins in New York. Eventually moved on to WABC and then to other stations, and he's very prominent in the film.
Hi, everybody all over America. This is your cousin Brucey. It's the WABC party. Go, go! Woo! From now until midnight tonight, we're on our party, and I know you're listening all over America, all over Canada, and it's really great.
Because of the national reach of a 50,000-watt clear channel radio station, by 9 o'clock at night, I was heard in 50 states from a local radio station in New York. There were no rules. We went on the air and did everything we wanted to do. Nobody bothered us. We were experimenting.
Come on, what's that, sweetheart?
Yes, well, Brucey survived AM, FM, and satellite. I mean, he's one of the few that have been through all three, and he has an amazing following. And he insists on doing a show live. He doesn't want to voice track anything. Yeah. You ever sit in a studio when he's on, and those phones light up the entire time he's there?
Well, Bruce became very popular. You'll see a lot of Cousin Brucey during this film. Murray the K, a man who is very close to my heart, in part because the Delicates. I work on a website with Denise Ferry and Bernadette Carroll. The website
is two of my favorite people.
Yeah. I'm going to mention
them.
That. Jersey Girls Sing. Denise was one of the three members of the Delicates, and the other two were Arlene Lanzotti and Peggy Santillia. And they wrote and sang most of Murray the K's theme songs, including his legendary Submarine Race Watcher theme. In the next minute and a half, you'll hear a portion of that, along with some comments from Murray's son Peter, and a little bit from Murray the K himself.
Bay, baby.
My father had an incredibly intimate relationship with his listeners. The idea that he was a friend to these people was very, very real. They responded to him as if he was an older brother whom they could trust. Submarine race watching was something he just came up with. And the idea was that if kids were going down to the riverside to watch the submarine races, there was nothing to see.
Wait a while. Until you love the baby, kiss a certain smile, then you turn to music and you hold them tight. And you watch the submarine make you love the night, and you're never too much.
When he did the rock and roll shows, it was for him and for his fans, I think, just a natural extension of getting closer to that person whom they'd come to know.
Happening. We want to welcome you to our show. We think it's going to be the swingin'est show of this or any year. And we want to tell you right now that it's a show for everybody.
Murray had a personality all his own. What do you recall about Murray?
Well, I didn't grow up in New York. So a lot of what I've learned about some of these people were air checks and just listening to them.
Right.
But Murray happened to, at the end of his career, work in Washington, D.C. when I was living there. And we were neighbors. We lived in the same building.
He was a showman.
Murray was a showman. Well, his family was vaudeville. I mean, he had an entertainment background. But he also didn't compromise. Murray did not compromise what he wanted to do and what he thought was the right thing for his audience.
Right.
And there's a clip in there later on in his career where he actually walked out of the first FM rock station because he was hired to be creative and to do what he did, and then he was told that there was going to be a playlist and it was going to be restricted, and he said, no. He said, I'd rather walk away than compromise my ideals.
He did it, and Roscoe also walked out. We're going to get to that a little bit later
Thank goodness Murray was showing, because there's more footage of Murray than probably any other disc jockey in that period. And I thank his son Peter Altshuler for that.
Surprisingly, though, there's no footage of the shows themselves. You see Murray, but actually footage of the acts performing, that's almost totally unavailable.
No. And in fact, the footage that's in was, it wasn't one of his stage shows. It was a show he did, I think, for the Job Corps in New York.
I was wondering where that was from.
Yeah, it was a TV show that he did. If anybody ever filmed those shows, the Brooklyn Fox and the Paramount and all of those, I've never seen it.
Well, Murray was very popular. Murray and Cousin Brucey, of course, in New York City.
Dan Ingram.
I have to play this clip of Dan Ingram from the film because it shows the power of radio.
WABC hit time with your Dan Ingram flavor. Yeah, just stomp right in there with your big muddy feet. That's the Sherrells, Big John, right here on your Dan Ingram show. This is Big Dan in the afternoon. How you doing, Kemosabe?
I was a listener's friend. They were my Kemosabe, which came from the Lone Ranger. I was on the air once. It's a very warm summer day, and all of a sudden, one of the people from the newsroom came bounding into the studio and started screaming at me, "You got to tell people don't use the Long Island Expressway. It's jammed up. It's closed. It's backed up for miles. Women could be having babies. Go on the air and tell them." Well, I went on the air and I said, you know, avoid the Long Island Expressway. But if you're sitting there in traffic, why don't you roll the window down? It's kind of a hot day. Wave to the guy in the car next to you. You may make a friend. About 6 months later, I got an invitation to a wedding.
Wasn't that nice?
That was wonderful. And, you know, there's some serious stories, too. Dan and Nick Biondi and I forget who else had stories that they actually saved listeners' lives. Dan told me there was somebody that was on the Brooklyn Bridge, I believe, and they were going to jump, and they said, you know, I was had my radio with me, and you made me laugh. And I thought, you know, maybe
life is worth living, and
yeah,
I'm going to
hang around. Dick Biondi said there was a story of a woman whose husband was arrested, and she was going to kill herself and her children. And he said, you know, there's a beautiful sunset. Everyone, go to the window and look at that sunset. And it made her stop and think. And the next day, it turned out her husband had been falsely accused and everything was okay. And she said, you know, you saved four lives.
Wow.
So that, you know, that one almost made me cry.
Well, we focused so far on New York City DJs. We're going to go to some other areas of the country. Jerry Blavitt, the geeter with the heater.
The boss of the hot dog.
What can you tell us about Jerry?
Now, there's another one who is dedicated to his music and his listeners, and he's been offered a lot of opportunities where he would have to go by a playlist and play, you know, what other people tell him to play, and he won't do it.
Philadelphia, we should point out.
Philadelphia, and I've been out with Jerry Blavitt in Philadelphia. You couldn't be more popular. I mean, the mayor doesn't get the kind of attention he gets. You can't walk down the street with Jerry without five people coming up to him.
Yeah.
He is the most beloved person in Philadelphia.
Yes, he
rightly
sure
so.
Is. He sure is, and has been for years, by the way. I've never had the pleasure of communicating with him, but maybe someday I will. Hopefully he will hear this show.
Oh, he will. And he loves the music. I mean, yes. This man doesn't just play it because it's what people want to hear. He loves it. He knows it. And he has a club in Margate called Memories. And I've walked in there where there are 100, 200 people, and someone will walk in, and he'll know their name, and he'll know if their husband's there or not, and he'll remember that it was somebody's birthday. He's amazing.
By the way, I want to tell all of our listeners that there's a great clip of Jerry Blavitt in the studio, and you see him putting a record on the turntable, introducing it. It's like the man has five hands. I mean, it's doing 10 things at once.
It's like going to a ballet.
The geeter with the heater, heater being all the record. Boom!
I am one with my audience. Happiness, sadness, loneliness. I'm attuned to where they've been.
The man's name is Mr. Jackie Leroy Wilson, and when you talk about the true
because
legend...
I was there.
And if you were watching Bandstand, you know the kids from Philadelphia were doing a dance called the 81. The group Candy and the Kisses out of Philadelphia. It's a carbon copy, though, of In My Lonely Room.
Talking, moving, relating what the music is about to the audience. Now, I'm looking for a record that follows suit with that energy.
You on the go, like my buddy Chuck Berry did say, with the hottest show on the
coming
radio.
Out of this?
This is coming from my heart, not a research chart, and this is the question.
Do you like good music?
Boom. My rhythm is always on that board. It's shuffling. So it's constant movement, constant rhythm. That's how I get my pacing.
Unbelievable. No, I didn't even know. I thought some of the DJs back then actually had engineers.
I think some of them did.
Some of them did, but Blavitt played his own stuff.
Yeah. There's a clip of Brucey from, I believe, 65, and there's an engineer in there with him.
Well, there's also, in addition to the ones we've mentioned, Casey Kasem. I used to be the East Coast researcher for American Top 40, so I have a very close tie with Casey Kasem. He makes several comments during the film.
And I got one very nice comment from him. He said, you know, I've been in this business a long time, and after I watched your film, I learned something.
Wow,
and that was one of the
something.
Nicest compliments I got the entire time.
Dick Biondi was from
Chicago.
And
he actually had started out in Louisiana in the early 50s, and he was one of those people who was playing R&B very early on. And then he went to WKBW in Buffalo in the late 50s, and then he went on to be a legend in Chicago.
And finally, in this particular segment, we're talking about various DJs. We have to mention Wolfman Jack. I'm going to clap for the Wolfman now. What can you tell us about Wolfman Jack?
Robert Smith. Well, you know, he started out in Mexico, you know, huge audience. And He was two people, from what everyone has told me. And, in fact, unfortunately, he passed away, but we did go to his house and talk with his wife. And she said there were two people. There was Wolfman and there was Bob. And he really was another one that just loved what he did. I think most of the people I've talked to that were on the air, that long careers, never wanted to do anything else and couldn't imagine themselves doing anything else. The funny story is when he was asked to do American Graffiti, because George Lucas was a huge Wolfman fan. And Wolfman's career hadn't really taken off at that point. And he read the script and he turned to George Lucas and he said, "This is really great. How much do I have to pay you to be in it?"
And the rest is history.
Exactly.
I'm Ronnie Allen and I'm talking with Carolyn Travis about her documentary that she did with her husband, Chris Fox Gilson. Does he usually use the middle name?
Not always.
Not always, but sometimes. Chris Fox Gilson or Chris Gilson.
Well, his dad was an author, too, so, you know, they had the same name, so he throws the Fox in there to avoid confusion.
Okay. The film is called Airplay, The Rise and Fall of Rock Radio.
And I want to take this opportunity to apologize to anyone that's listening that's saying, why didn't you use, insert the name of your favorite DJ? Because believe me, I would have loved to have talked about everybody, but 50 years and 95 minutes is a little tricky.
Yeah.
But wherever we go, it's yes, we love the show, it's wonderful, but I mean, we were in L.A., I think there are three stations in L.A. we mentioned, and somebody came up with a fourth one that they happened to listen to and wanted to know why that wasn't in there.
You're going to see other DJs in this film we want to point out. Actually, let's listen to a little bit of Jocko Henderson. Where was Jocko, in Philadelphia?
He was in Philadelphia and in New York.
Here's a little bit of Jocko. And Jocko sadly passed away shortly after you did this interview.
Right.
You got the rock with Jocko like a bull on the dock, a pop a dock and do the boogaloo too.
I was rapping then. Jocko the ace from outer space with a rocket ship. Whenever I said E to the yacht.
Ho! This is Jock.
And I'm back on the scene.
With the record machine saying. How do you do?
They'd say the same thing. Right back at me. My listeners and I had love affair. I love the ground they walked on.
You get a little close to the radio here. Cynthia, come on now. Get up close.
Jocko told me at one point he had shows in both Philadelphia and New York. And he would do the Philadelphia show, get on a train, go to New York, do the New York show, get on a train, come back to do the Philadelphia show the next day. He was, you know, before you could do something like that from your home or satellite or whatever, he was in two markets at the same time.
There's a lady who worked in Detroit.
Martha Jean the Queen. She started out in Memphis, WDIA. She said originally they were looking for a woman to do a cooking show, and she looked at them and said, "Well, I don't cook." She was quite a lady, and she went on to Detroit, and she actually owned her own station, and she was very involved in the community. She was one of those disc jockeys that really made a difference in the city she lived in, and she would get the auto workers to tell her when something was happening. And well, she did something very sneaky. She actually had the auto workers tell her when they were getting their vacation pay or when something was happening, and then she would tell the wives. She said, "Now you go to the factory, and when they come out, you tell them you want that vacation paycheck so they don't blow it." And then one day she told me that her car was stolen, and she got on the air and said, "Can you believe this? Someone stole the Queen's car." She said, "You know, my fans are not going to like this." And she said by the time she got off the air, not only was it back, but it was clean with a full tank of gas. She told me DIA was an interesting station because they would do everything. They were the voice of the community, because she said back then in Memphis, I guess everywhere, but mostly in the South, there were no black politicians, there were no black civic leaders, that the voice of the black community was really the black disc jockey. Okay. So when somebody had a political statement, they would call the station. And she said that one day someone called and said they had lost their false teeth, and would they go on the air and ask someone to look for them. I don't know who would have done that, but she said they really were the voice of their community because there was no other black leader at that time.
One point I would like to make, it applies to all of the DJs we've mentioned so far. These were the days of personality radio.
Yes.
They were not the days where a disc jockey would just play records and just announce the name of the record, the time, the weather, and then just get to the next record. These people actually had personalities.
Yeah, they did.
It eventually changed.
Two things I'd like to say about the AM DJs. I don't know if it was because when we were growing up and the first generation of AM jocks were a little older than us, that it was nice to know there was one really cool grown-up out there that understood us. But there was a relationship between you and your DJ. And when we go around and do these film festivals, people will come up to us and say, you know, I don't remember who my best friend was in third grade, but I remember the disc jockey I listened to. And they will go on and tell you stories and get misty when they see their DJ on the screen. It's just an incredible bond. And I think a lot of kids today who either listen to satellite or download from iTunes or listen to syndicated radio shows where the guy isn't their guy in their city are missing out on a lot. I grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, right outside D.C. I couldn't find a clip of my guy that I listened to in D.C., but, man, I got an air check. I don't even know how we put it in there. I told my husband, you're going to find a place for this because my guy's going to be in this show. Yeah. And my guy was Harv Moore from WPGC.
This is Morsel, the boy Harv here, the boy next door on WPGC Good Guys Radio.
I actually tracked him down, had a very nice conversation with him, and I felt like I was about 13 years old again after that. The one other thing I want to say about these guys is when I interviewed them, there was not one diva in the bunch. Everybody was so nice and so willing to share, and if there's no footage of your particular guy, it's because they didn't have any, because everyone that had something, I mean, Brucey opened up his house to us and said, go look through my things and take what you want. They were all just the nicest, most generous, warm, cooperative bunch of people I've ever met.
And they were very honest in telling what happened, what the story was.
Yeah, they were.
They didn't pull any punches.
Not at all.
We want to point out that, for the most part, it's a pretty good feel-good film, but it also goes into areas which are not so feel-good. And it basically is a balanced picture of what happened to rock radio over a 50-year period. I still, at this point, Carolyn, don't even know if you really know how important it is what you've done here.
Someone told me, and I wish I could think of the name, that I'm the equivalent of the photographer that went out and photographed the last Indian tribes. It's amazing that so many of the disc jockeys are, I mean, Dick Biondi's still on the air, Brucey's still on the air.
Yes, Jerry Blavitt.
Jerry. Jerry will be on the air forever. He's
he'll
be on for another 100
he'll
years.
He'll be on the air forever is right. As a result of the payola, the FCC decided that maybe the way to get rid of the payola is you designate somebody to be kind of a watcher. So they brought in people called program directors.
Right. But the interesting thing was the program directors were really just another person that they could bribe if they wanted to. it took it out of the individual DJ's hands. But who's to say that the program directors weren't taking bribes? But it took away the freedom and the creativity because these guys came in and said, you know, we don't really care. There's one quote, I don't even know, it was from documentary called Anatomy of a Hit that was done in the early 60s, and there's somebody in there was a program director that said, I let my DJs choose two songs selection.
Yes.
Big deal.
Big deal.
The guys
right.
who were used to playing the music that they loved, that was not, such a great compromise. You know, another thing, though, in those days is there was so much, another reason it was such a shared experience for kids of that generation is they were playing everything. They were playing R&B and Bubblegummy and Teen Idol and girl groups. But now, you know, when they listen to radio, it's so fragmented that there's not that sense of shared experience.
Right.
Because, unless you're listening to the exact same station, you're not getting the same music.
There were a couple of gentlemen by the name of Todd Storrs and Gordon McClendon, and they came up with a concept that they called Top 40 Radio.
Well, Top 40 Radio, Storrs actually started that in the 50s. I mean, it didn't become really popular until after payola when they needed that kind of control.
Okay.
But the actual concept for Top 40 came about in the 50s.
And it was like listeners would love to hear 40 songs that were in an order, like a chart, like a countdown.
Well, their inspiration came from the fact that, according to legend, and there's a lot of different legends out there, there were 40 songs on the jukebox. The legendary story is that they were sitting in a bar trying to figure out what to do because television was really taking a big chunk out of radio's ratings. And they were watching people put money in a jukebox, and they said, do you realize they're just playing the same songs over and over? There are many, many theories about how it happened. That's just the one that we hear the most.
But basically, Todd Storrs and Gordon McClendon developed a concept called Top 40 Radio, and ultimately, what that wound up doing is taking a certain amount of control out of the DJ's hands.
Yes.
And in the process, unfortunately, it also directly and indirectly led to the demise of personality radio.
Yes. Besides not being able to pick their own music, they were also told, okay, this is a structured hour. You're going to play tune 1, 2, and 3. You've got 30 seconds to do your ID, say your name, give the time and weather, and back to the next song. So they didn't have the time to really interact with their audience like they used to.
Now, you had a series of events. AM radio was still thriving. The assassination of JFK, which was followed shortly thereafter by the advent of Beatlemania.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you got to the mid-60s, there was the advent of FM radio playing rock and roll. One of the first stations to do it was 1967, WOR in New York.
And there were a couple of things that led up to that. Now, you know, people come up to me and say, well, you know, WABC was still on up until the late 70s. And yes, there were a lot of viable AM stations, and they still existed, and they still did well. But what brought about the FM revolution, as we call it, was that there was a law passed that stations could no longer simulcast. So when they had to come up with new programming on their FM stations, a lot of these FM stations weren't making any money, so they were looking for cheap ways to program, so they would recruit from college radio stations, and they weren't getting a lot of sponsors except people who would want to sell things to, you know, the kids. And they really paid no attention to it because they didn't think that that was where their money was going to be coming from.
Right.
So there was that, and there was also that albums came out in stereo then.
Right.
And AM sound quality wasn't as good. FM had a much better sound quality, so people that were really into music wanted to hear their music on FM radio.
And instead of playing the single version of a song, they would play the longer album version.
Mm-hmm. Because nobody cared. There wasn't that much commercial activity going on. So, yeah, play the 18-minute Inagata De Vita. We don't care.
Yeah, you play the longer Inagata De Vita would be longer than this entire interview.
Well, that is actually known as the bathroom break song in radio.
The thing that I noticed about FM radio, and Murray the Cave and Scott Muni were on there, all of a sudden they became more mellow.
Yeah.
It was like the personality changed. Not just the presentation of the music, not just the length of the music, but they were not as wild.
Well, a lot of it was the first generation of kids that grew up on rock and roll were coming of age and going to their college radio stations. I don't really know why it changed completely, but a lot of it was the times. I mean, people were smoking pot and the music was not that Little Richard, you know, high energy. It was Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Vanilla Fudge. The music was changing. The attitude in the country was changing.
Vietnam War.
Yes, and what was the Cousin Bruce? He said, I don't know, I wasn't used to this. Let's smoke a banana and play an 18-minute cut.
One of these electrical bananas. Yes. Initially, when you had FM radio come in, the DJs had quite a bit of freedom. What ultimately ended up happening as a result of FM radio doing this is that a lot of times record companies would start releasing longer singles.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, instead of a single averaging 2.5 minutes, it ends up averaging 3.5. FM radio is quite different from AM radio.
But there were also really two FM radio revolutions. There was the New York WOR, where it was the tried and true disc jockeys being given a new life and a new opportunity to be creative. And then there was Underground, which really started with Tom Donahue at KMPX in San Francisco, where they were really the hippie radio station where they'd just bring in their own albums and play what they felt like playing and smoke a joint on the air. And he was the first person to give people like the Jefferson Airplane and the Doors and the Grateful Dead airplay that no one else would touch.
Well, there was also controversy about some of the stuff that radio was playing, and maybe it was underground radio that was doing a lot of these so-called drug-influenced songs and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Rachel Donahue said that there was a Steppenwolf song called The Pusher, and the lawyer came in because they'd gotten a lot of complaints about it, and she said, well, you don't understand. This is anti-drug. It's damning the pusher. And the lawyer said, yeah, but did they have to damn him 18 times? So there was a lot of people upset about the language and the drug content in songs, and yes, it did get a lot of controversy.
Actually, the FM revolution, the honeymoon didn't last all that long, did it?
Not with WOR, no.
About a year later, Murray the K quit on the air. Why?
Because they did an about face. They hired Murray the K and Roscoe and Scott Muni, all of them, to be creative, to do what they did best. And then they changed it. They said, well, you know, we thought about it, and no, we don't want you to do that. Here's a playlist. It's going to be pretty much top 40 radio, but with a better signal. And
right.
They said, no, this is not what we want to do. We're creative people, and we'd rather walk out and go somewhere else than do this. And they did. And they did it live on the air.
It's been a very, very groovy experience here at WOR-FM. Tonight will be my last broadcast. This is going to be my last night at WOR-FM, and that has to do with a group of consultants and what they're asking me to do. I feel it would be very disrespectful and dishonest to you, and I don't see any other course.
Murray McKay and Roscoe resigning on the air.
Yeah.
So basically, a lot of the FM stations were taking more and more control away from the disc jockeys.
Yeah, because they, you know, there was Metro Media, there were corporations that owned chains of stations.
Right.
And it became a big investment for them, and they just were not going to let a bunch of stoned-out hippies run the station.
Is it fair to say that the corporations were seeing, like, what was getting played and how it was getting played as being more important than the DJs that played it?
Yes, and also then research came along, and Lee Abrams gets the brunt of the blame for starting that whole research movement. And he said to us, I had good intentions, it just really got out of hand.
Yes.
So all of a sudden it was, you know, you could only play what tested well. And there's a little clip, Meg Griffin, who's been in radio, I guess, since the early years of FM, and she's on Sirius XM now. She said they were doing a test group, and she really wanted to play Bob Marley.
One of the big wigs at that radio station told me a few things he had learned, and I said, well, did you by any chance test Bob Marley? And he said, yeah, because we weren't playing any. And I really wanted to. And I said, and what happened when you tested Bob Marley? Oh, it came back really positive. So I said, oh, good. Then we're going to start to play some. Now, here's where it's faulty. He said, no, people just say they like Bob Marley because they think it's cool. We'll just play Eric Clapton's version of I Shot the Sheriff. And I was like, that's it.
If they pretty much knew that they were going to do this anyway and go with the Clapton record rather than the Marley record, why do the research at all? If you know what you're going to do, it was like lip service.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I'm sure some of the things that they found out in those groups they used, but if it was something they didn't feel themselves, I guess they had the right to interpret it any way they wanted.
In other words, we're going to do the research, and then we're going to do exactly what we please.
Exactly, but we can say we did the research.
We can say we did the research. One of the very interesting aspects of the film is the Ropey Young story, and I want to point out that this had to do with the rumors that were spreading that Paul McCartney was dead, and actually, Ropey Young was not the first DJ that was talking about those rumors. There was another DJ that was doing it first.
It was a guy named Russ Gibb in Detroit, and he got a call from a listener that said, what's this I've heard about McCartney being dead? And he asked Russ Gibb to play Revolution No. 9 backwards, and he did, and it was the first time that Turn Me On, Dead Man was heard live on the radio, and nobody really knows where it started. There are a million different theories about where the story started. Some people say that the record company put it out to promote sales. Some people say some stone kid in his room thought he heard something, but nobody's ever really definitively said where it comes from. But yes, he did, and it started, I was in college then, and I remember sitting there playing the record backwards and turning the magical mystery tour upside down and reading the numbers. We did all of that, and Ropey Young went on the air, and of course he was on WABC, 50,000 watt station, heard all over the country.
And Carolyn, in the film, you are on camera telling the story.
WABC overnight DJ Ropey Young defied station policy and started talking about the rumors.
The Beatle Paul may be dead. I'm talking to 40 states right now, and I'll surely get fired if I say anything unusual. But the fact is, folks, I've been fired anyhow.
They got over 350,000 calls.
And I'm not going to be cut now because it's 12:39 at night and there's nobody standing by to cut the switch.
He was wrong about that.
The program director rushed in with an armed guard, ripped him off the air while he was on the air live.
But please remember you heard it here first in the middle of the night, okay? Because I'm not going to be around that much longer.
And put Les Marshak on the air to substitute for Ropey Young.
Les Marshak here, and, you know, we've been getting some phone calls regarding some speculating that Ropey Young was doing earlier this morning. Please be assured that those speculations are untrue. They are untrue. Please don't call, all right?
Actually, basically what happened is they had told Ropey they were not going to renew his contract.
Right.
That way he was fired.
Right.
So he figured, I'm going to go out with a bang. And he did. He made himself a legend. He did that.
Actually, he went down to Florida after that, and he was struck by lightning. That didn't kill him, but he was struck by lightning, and then he died a few years after that.
During the 50 years that radio has been playing rock and roll, one thing that is for certain is that radio, for better or for worse, was a tremendous force. It affected so many people's lives, and radio was certainly never irrelevant.
No. You're right.
The last chapter in your film is about satellite radio.
Mm-hmm. We started shooting this when there were two companies, Sirius and XM, and pretty much in the middle of our editing, they merged. We were hoping that was going to be the next bastion of freedom for DJs, because when XM started, especially their decades channels, like 50s, 60s, 70s, they had pretty much every song that had ever been released on a CD in their database. So we were thinking, oh, great, we're going to get to hear everything again. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see what they do now that they've merged.
There's a lot of channels out there.
Yeah, and the thing is that's interesting, too, is a lot of cities now, especially smaller markets, they don't have a classical station or a country western or sometimes even a R&B station, and the only way people can get all the music they want to hear now is to go on satellite.
There is a DJ who is on satellite, and his name is Flash Phelps. Flash is a character, and
he is a personality DJ brought back to life.
And where is he?
On the 60s channel.
And Flash did this particular thing, which you will see him do in the film, where he's talking about all of the states.
He's been in all 50 states now, and he can name them all in 30 seconds.
Well,
and he really can. I've timed him.
You're going to hear him do this right now, and if you see the film, you'll actually be able to see him do this segment.
I know the entire United States. By the time I was 23, I had already been in 49 states, and by the time I turned 30, I'd been to all 50. And I just wanted to go to every market in America. I was very big into air checking, which is taping all these radio stations. So I'd sit in McDonald's parking lots, and I'd tape all the radio stations locally.
And Flash has been through every state in the USA. Names them all in 30 seconds on any given day.
New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Utah, Kansas, California, Arkansas, Louisiana, Minnesota, Indiana, Illinois, both the Dakotas, New York, and the two Virginias, Massachusetts, Idaho, the Carolinas, and Ohio, Connecticut, Maryland, Nevada, Delaware, Rhode Island, Mississippi, Wisconsin, Vermont, Michigan, Wyoming, Kentucky, Texas, Oregon, Missouri, Florida, Washington, New Mexico, and Arizona, Iowa, Oklahoma, Colorado, Montana, Nebraska, Alabama, Georgia, Jersey, Tennessee, Alaska, D.C., and Hawaii. That's all of them.
Well, Carolyn, I don't think there's any way we could actually follow Flash Phelps.
No. Except to say that personality radio is alive and well, and isn't that nice.
Well, you know, Flash Phelps makes that Federal Express guy sound slow.
Yes.
I've watched your film 3 times. In fact, I watched it last night because you did a presentation. You were on a Philadelphia station, WHYY, Channel 12, and the Geeter brought you on. In fact, the Geeter was co-hosting that show, and your husband was on there too, and you were talking about the film, and they ran the film, and that was the only market in the country that actually saw the film, right?
So far. We're hoping that's going to inspire other PBS stations to buy it.
The Geeter was talking about it as if it's the second coming of Gone with the Wind.
See, I really do love him. And Ed, the other host, too. I couldn't believe it. I said, I was ready to call and order one.
The film that you've made with your husband is absolutely mesmerizing. And anybody who has ever listened to and enjoyed rock and roll radio, whether it was AM, FM, satellite, you will love this film. What is your website?
It's www.travesty.tv.
Travesty.tv.
And there will be something coming up soon called the Airplay Channel, and we'll be posting updates on that on our website.
Well, actually, what I'm going to tell our listeners now, I'm going to give away a little secret if I might, Carolyn.
Yeah.
What our listeners don't know is that you and I have now been talking for 26 hours straight doing this interview.
I'm on my 18th cup of
coffee here. We have to reduce this to a one-hour show.
I have to reduce a 26-hour documentary to 95 minutes, so I don't feel sorry for you.
But I thank you for the 26 hours you've spent today. We started this actually about 1 o'clock yesterday.
Yes, we did.
You did hop off to Philadelphia to do that show, though. Nobody's going to believe this. Okay, we're going to get out of this. Carolyn, I wish you oodles of success with this film.
Yeah.
I know how much work you put into it, and it shows.
Well, it's a lot of love in it, too, believe me.
And you told me one of the greatest pleasures was you actually watched the film at a screening with Lance Fried.
Yes, and he liked it. I was scared to death, and I kept looking over at him, and when it got to the end of the Alan Freed section, he just smiled at me. I went, oh, thank goodness.
Carolyn, I wish you all the best with this film. We want to remind our listeners to look for this. The film is called Airplay, The Rise and Fall of Rock Radio. And Carolyn, I wish you all the success in the world. I assume you have some more projects in the future.
Yeah, as soon as I take a nap after this one.
I want to say one blanket thank you. And I guess I could do this on your behalf as well, Carolyn. I want to say thank you to all of the members of the DJ community who have done something wonderful that has touched so many people's lives.
And that's exactly how I feel.
We dance to the jukebox while the lights Bumble and the Stingers, Martha Hooper, Rachel Singers, Lonnie Mackett, Twang and Eddie, Hisman, Ring, we're going steady, take it easy, take me high, lie, lie, house of fire, locomotion, poker, patch, deep for purple satisfaction, baby, baby, gotta, give me, getting hotter, Sammy's cooking, Leslie, Cora, Richie, Valens, end of story, my piece of Fuji, I'm a Kama Sutra, Rama, Lama, Richard, Perry, Spectre, Barry, Righteous, Archer, Dilson, Harry, Shimmy, Jimmy, Coco, Pop, it, Fats, back and finger, Pop, it, tabulation, Carly Simon, Levy, Holder, Rolling Stone, and a folder. Johnny Cash and Johnny Rivers, Kansas, now I got the shivers. Mungo, Jerry, Peter, Peter, Paul, Paul, and Mary, Mary, Dr. John, and Nightly Tripper, Doris Day, and Jack the Ripper. Gotta go, so gotta sweat a Leah Russell. Give me Sheldon, Miracles, and Smokey Blitz, Sly Guitars, and Fender Bass, and Mushroom Mama, Bonnie Brown, and Wilson Pickett, stop, I can't get
life is a rock.
Brandon, Norman, Oakland, Denver, John and Austin, Donnie, Jesse, Kayla, ZZ, Top and LLB, then DD, Donna, David Bowie, Steely Dan, and Sing Me Proud of CC Ryder, Andrew Wiener, Jonas, Summers, Isaac, Mark, Johnny, Fonda, Eric, Clapton, Peter Wallace, Steve, LaFrance, Doo-Dah, Doo-Dah, Cool Vibrations, Lovey, Ronda, Surfing Girl, Little Honda, Titus, Tida, Honey, Honey,